Hey, this is Dr. Nick and Andrew Datto, and we're just about to start Get a Freaking Life. Welcome to this episode.
G'day, welcome to another Get a Freaking Life. Andrew Datto with you with Dr. Nick Lucas, and Nick, very excited about today's guest.
Absolutely. I mean, you couldn't be more excited, really, could you, especially with your background in surfing and everything, which we'll have to get into.
Well, it's funny because we've got the guest and I have very different backgrounds in surfing. She can do it. I simply try. And look, we often start with a story, and I'm talking about Lane Beachley, seven-time world surfing champion, not arguably, easily the best female surfer in the history of the sport. And her story is incredible. It's a long one that goes, because I've seen her speak a bunch of times doing an award roadshow with her. It starts from when she was really quite young to an ever-evolving story now. So I think we'll just get straight into it and welcome Lane Beachley. How are you, Lane?
Good, Andrew. And Nick, how are you?
We are both excellent. I think I could speak for Andrew on his behalf.
Yeah. Yes, you can.
And now I know you just got
You're out a doctor. You're allowed to.
That's right.
Now, look, I know you just got out of the surf, and yes. And I know that you know this is called Get a Freaking Life. And we usually talk to people who have been doing one thing and then they've gone into something else that will, you know, help save or change or holistically make the world a better place. I get the feeling you've had a freaking life your whole life. Is that an unfair look from the outside?
That's a very astute look from the outside. It's been a freaking journey, that's for sure. It's been a remarkable life, and it's one that I continue to live. My motto these days is actually live a life that you love. So get a freaking life and live it and then love it, because you won't work a day in your life.
Okay, but when you look at, you know, so you travel the world and you surfed everywhere at the best places at the best times, surely that would have been, I mean, you know, that seems to be everyone's, or anyone who's interested in surfing or the ocean, that looks like a dream life.
And it was a dream life. I think everything upon reflection, we all have 20/20 hindsight, and sometimes we get so consumed by a victimized mentality or the negative aspects of our lives that we allow that to dictate our joy or our pain. And when I reflect on my career, yes, there was a lot of hardship, there was a lot of tragedy, there was a lot of adversity, and there was a lot of struggle, but ultimately I reflect on my career as a professional surfer as one of the most blessed times of my life. It was a remarkable opportunity to get paid to go surfing for a living. Guaranteed, you know, you've got to become successful to be paid well. Well, back in my day, he did. I was number two in the world, earning $8,000 a year, working four different jobs, up to 60, 70 hours a week, which made my life pretty challenging.
Yeah, can you say that again? Just go for that, just slowly.
So you can keep
it did
up.
Kind of shoot right past.
Yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
So you're number two in the world.
Yeah, I was number two in the world. I was earning $8,000 a year from my sponsor at the time.
Sorry, so did you say 800,000, right? That's what you
eight,
said.
8,000.
8,000.
Eight, oh. 8 with three zeros after it, 8,000. And I was working four different jobs, and around about 60 hours a week, I think I was working for $8 an hour, mind you, back then there was the award wage with no double time and weekend pay.
And double time surfing, and a half, thanks, mate, Sunday.
Yeah. No, they wouldn't give it to me. They certainly made me work double time and a half. Right. And then I was surfing once or twice a week, and I was still trying to train every day as well. So there was a lot on my plate, and it was really frustrating at the time because I was obviously so committed to achieving my dreams and no one believed in me, so it made it very difficult.
Were there others surfing at the time who were doing, you know, maybe not number two, who were doing better than you financially out of the sport?
Yes.
That was and that was your frustration?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, frustration comes from a variety of places. Usually you're comparing yourself to something outside of you, and that's when you start to feel inadequate, and then you get frustrated and you start laying the blame and pointing the finger, and it's everybody else's fault. And sooner or later you have to realize that you have to take control and accountability and responsibility for the way that you think, which automatically creates the way that you feel. And I realized that I was allowing external factors to determine my levels of enjoyment and satisfaction in life, and I had to start taking control. But I realized also that the amount of work that I was doing outside of the water was sabotaging and affecting adversely my performance in the water. So something had to give, and I had to back myself and commit myself to just spending more time in the surf and less time out of the water. And, of course, that affected my income and my ability to earn a living. But you either have to commit to one sport, which will increase you, or one aspect of your life, which will increase your likelihood of succeeding in it, or you can direct your attention in two different ways and hope one works out. So I just decided that I had to stop working so hard and really start committing myself to training and surfing and invest all my time and energy into that, which would then produce the results, which would then generate the sponsorship and the support.
Do you remember where you were or the place you're in when you made the decision? Or did you have to make it over and over again, or was there a time?
I had to make it over and over again. So I remember when I won my first championship tour event, it was 1993. I won $8,000 US for winning that event. Now the girls are winning 60 grand, which is fantastic. I still can't believe where women's surfing is today. But we're reflecting on the hard times. In 1993, I was also diagnosed with chronic fatigue the week after I won my first event. I won my first paycheck. The next day I was working back at the surf shop. And it just kept putting things back into perspective for me that, you know, you go from being on top of the world and back to just working behind a store and serving people
and when,
wetsuits and
board shorts. When you got back to the surf shop, so the next day or, you know, 2 days later, so they would have gone, hey, congratulations, that's great. But did that last for very long, that discussion, or was it pretty much good on you now, you know, your spot lane? Because that's what surfing
back
in Manly, wasn't it? I mean, that's how it sort of was.
Well, that's the great thing about Manly is that the place changes, but the faces never do. You know, you feel very humbled and connected when you're back at Manly, and if you come back with an ego, then it's smashed out of you very quickly.
Yeah.
It's a very humbling environment to grow up in, and it keeps you well grounded and connected to where you come from. I think it's one of the great life lessons that I've received from growing up in Manly is to never forget where you come from. And there's been a lot of, to answer Nick's question in a long-winded way, yes, there were several times when I wanted to quit. There were several times when it was all too hard. There were several times when I had to make a decision. Do I keep going? Do I sacrifice? Do I jeopardize? Do I remain focused? There was so many times. And fortunately, I had wonderful people around me who I refer to as my honesty barometers. They were my friendship circle, who at times believed in me more than I believed in myself, but they weren't always the ones that had the answers. They would just pose the right questions, and they were always there willing to listen and support me when I needed that support. And there was a couple of times, such as in 93 when I went back to work, when I was questioning my ability, even though I've just won and beat the world champion at the time. And it was my personal trainer that said, come on, you can keep going. And then it was Daryl Eastlake that basically said, if you ever win a world title, you will set yourself up for life. So commit to winning that world title. And then 2 years later, I had chronic fatigue again and a whole host of injuries, and I wanted to quit. And then one of my employers gave me a check to basically say, here, I believe in you. And he sent me off around the world. And then finally in 1997, the year before I won my first world title, I was ready to give it all away again. And my personal trainer sat me down and asked me the hard questions, like, what is it that you really want? I said, I want a world title. And he said, well, how much is it going to take for you to achieve that? And I said, 100% effort. And he goes, well, how much are you investing into it right now? And I said, oh, quite honestly, 65 to 70. He goes, so there's your answer for you. It's up to you now to make the decision. Do you want to continue and invest the time and energy and repay and respect the amount of energy that people are investing in you, or are you going to walk away and regret it for the rest of your life?
Did you think that you were putting in, I know you said 65%, but before that you'd been asked that question, were you going, bloody hell, I try so hard, I'm giving this everything I've got?
I was in denial.
Yeah, of course. So, but it's good to hear you say that, because I think all of us go, you know, I work so hard.
I know. And no one understands. Right.
And so, but you must have asked yourself that before.
Yes, absolutely. But the thing is that we do a whole lot of unconscious self-sabotage, and we're not even aware of it. And so I thought, I had this unrealistic, idealistic view that commitment was working all day and then deciding to go out that night, and instead of coming home and getting a decent sleep, or instead of not even going out, I would go out all night and come home and go, oh, it's a bit, you know, it's 4:30 in the morning, I've got training in half an hour, I might as well just stay up and go straight to training. Mm. That was commitment.
Well, yeah. I think that's fairly strong commitment. At least you went to training.
At least I did. You know, I was committed to training, but I was also sabotaging the effort.
But you also have to work on the premise that you've got to enjoy yourself as well, right? Like you're in the prime of your... I mean, you're literally in the prime of your life. You can't...
Yes.
You're strongest, you look best, you're having the most fun. So there's got to be a place for that too.
Absolutely. It's about identifying those life balances, because we tend to talk about work-life balances being diametrically opposed, but actually it can be one and the same, as long as you have a real tactile or tangible understanding of what it is and what it's going to take for you to achieve your dreams and how committed you are to achieving that, and then honoring your body, listening to yourself, trusting your intuition, trusting your instincts, relying on the people that you have around you, and maintaining a really healthy balance and healthy perspective on life.
So you got a freaking life, most definitely.
Yes,
now,
I did.
Now you've got one. Yeah. How are you still getting one? What's going on?
Well, I take the time to do things that I love, and that's what I mean by having a freaking life, because, I actually scheduled this interview knowing that I got off a plane at midday, and if I'd given myself 2 hours, I know I would have had the time to get home, get changed, go surf, come back and be on the couch ready to have this. So that's why I kept kind of putting Andrew off a little bit, because I schedule my day, I schedule my week, I schedule all my appointments around the surf forecast, and because that's what I love to do, that's what keeps me in balance, that's what keeps my life in perspective, and number one thing it does is actually make me happy and feel really good. So I prioritize that part of my life, and if there's no surf, then I just at least have to immerse myself in nature.
Do you subscribe to the theory of 30,000 hours will get you a gold medal or whatever?
No, I subscribe to the theory of 10,000 hours.
Oh, 10,000 hours, so whatever it is. So you reckon if you had, you know, you saw a five-year-old and he's pretty good at surfing, you could say, right, if you put in the time, you can have the result?
I don't want to put that kind of pressure on a five-year-old.
No, but you know what? Okay.
It's
fine. It's actually a hypothetical five-year-old, so you can do it.
No, so I've read Outliers, and I love what Malcolm Gladwell talks about in that book. And he also talks about the three things that I think have gone a little bit unnoticed in regards to what contributes to a human being's success, and that's opportunity, ability, and arbitrary advantage. And there are three main considerations on top of the 10,000 hours that you have to have for you to even become successful at something. Obviously, my arbitrary advantage is that I grew up on the beach at Manly, not out in the western suburbs. So therefore, I had that constant access to the beach. And then the opportunity was that my brother was a surfer, my dad was a surfer, so I was instantly introduced to surfing at a very young age, and then I had the natural ability of balance. I certainly didn't have the natural ability to surf, and I had to work very hard at that, but I had really good balance.
Hey, so talking about that 10,000 hours thing, Tim Ferriss has got a different idea.
Yes.
That it doesn't. And one of the things I found really interesting is his idea that you ask an amateur, you ask what are the three most common mistakes that an amateur makes, and then ask a pro what are the three most common mistakes that a pro makes, and by combining those together, you get six things. If you don't make those mistakes, you're going to get really good really fast. What would you say are the three most common mistakes that pros make in surfing?
Three most common mistakes I think pro surfers make would be, well, firstly, overthinking it. It's really easy, and I see this in all pro athletes, actually. We tend to overthink it. We overcomplicate it, and we make it more difficult than it needs to be. And the thing, especially with sport and in business and in life, there's so many variables that you could take into consideration that actually give you a reason not to succeed. And if you tend to focus on those, then you'll actually increase the likelihood of the lack of success. You'll increase the likelihood of attracting what you don't want. So overthinking, it's one thing. Number two is self-belief issues. It's funny how we become so successful, yet that's when we start to believe that we're not good enough. And so we start to doubt and question And I think it's really important that you start to learn to listen to that inner dialogue and understand whether it's serving you or whether it's not serving you. So a lack of self-belief is something that tends to erode away successful people's confidence. And I know I had that issue when I became, when I'm number two in the world, everyone says you can do it. When I became number one in the world, everyone's like, okay, we'd like to see you lose now. You've got what you want. It's our turn. And so I so wanted to be a world champion time after time after time because I became so addicted to winning. But then when I became number one, I put all this unrealistic amount of expectation on my shoulders, expecting myself to be a whole lot better than what I was. And I had to become aware of that. My boyfriend at the time, Ken Bradshaw, was a big wave surfer. He nicknamed that inner dialogue that I had, he nicknamed it as the worm. And he could see it infiltrating into my mind. He could see it permeating my brain and going, oh, the worm's back in. You could just see it in my body language and the way that I spoke and the way and my attitude and my actions. You could tell that the worm was back in there. So have also, you know, being aware of that. And then the last thing is, I think the biggest mistake pros make is they surround themselves with yes people.
Yeah.
And I never did that in my career. I just want honesty barometers in my life. I don't want people to tell me how great I am. I surround myself with people that bring me back down to earth and keep me honest. And, you know, my surf coach, when I was number two in the world, I went up and I was struggling to get to number one. I'd gone from second to third to second. I was like, what is it that's holding me back? And I went and saw I found a surf coach who was working with other world champions. And he said, after watching me surf for the first session, he said, I hate to tell you this, Lane, but because you've taught yourself how to surf, you've taught yourself very poorly, you're going to have to forget everything you know and start again.
But, I understand that because, I often see that in golf. You know, a lot of golfers will go through, you know, they'll play off three or four and they'll go, I had to relearn my swing. And you go, well, that's sort of ridiculous.
Mm.
When they're judging a surf competition, what are they judging just in relation to that last comment that you were getting so wrong? I mean, it's turns and...
It's speed and flow. And the flow part was what I was lacking.
Okay, so you could do the turns and you could go fast. You couldn't link them up.
No, I couldn't link them up because it was like watching someone join the dots. I was over-surfing the conditions because I'm such a powerful surfer and I'm a heavy back foot surfer. I was over-surfing it, so I wasn't really allowing my board or the wave to do any of the work for me. So it was... If you can visualize a surfer, someone going, and then,
Join the dots things are great. Great. Yeah, so I can see that straight away.
Yeah, great. There's no flow to it.
But that's got to be a really great business analogy when you do your business talks onto how to get from one spot to the next spot as well.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, start working with your elements as opposed to resisting them. And, yes, actually, it's a really good point, Andrew. I'll use that the next time.
Just so you know, Nick, Lane is a really great speaker and shares her story really well in a corporate sense, and it's terrific, you know.
Oh, thanks, Andrew.
No, you are. You're really compelling. Hey, look, what about – so I'm looking at, you know, surfers pro surfers might lack self-belief – and they surround themselves with yes people. Surely yes people can help that self-belief from time to time as well.
It's great to have people around you that boost you up and fuel your confidence, but ultimately it comes down to how you feel and how you think, because our brain is broken up into two brains. We've got the conscious mind and the subconscious mind, and if your thoughts, which are your conscious mind, are not aligned with your subconscious mind, then you're going to have that misalignment and that self-sabotage. So it's great when people tell you that you can, but if you don't believe you can, and it's great having people tell you that you're fantastic, but if you don't believe you're fantastic, then you're never going to be able to generate the results that you want, because there's always going to be that misalignment.
Okay. What about...
And that's one of the things that I noticed in the first 8 years of my career. I always wanted to be a world champion, and that's what I thought. But as Oprah says, you don't manifest what you want. You actually manifest what you believe. And I believed that I wasn't good enough, and I believed that I would never make it because I was constantly told that I never would. So I allowed all these external factors and experiences to determine who I was and what I stood for. And until I started to eliminate all of the external chatter and start to truly rely on myself and truly listen to myself and become aware of that inner dialogue and that self-deprecating behaviour, then I started to take ownership of my life. And when you can control your mind, you can control your life. But you've just got to start with that simple state of awareness.
So are you a believer in The Secret?
Yeah, I love The Secret. I actually contributed to Rhonda's second book,
you?
Hero.
Oh, okay. I mean, I don't know. What about saying to kids, you know, you can be anything you want? I don't know if I buy into that.
I know. No, most people don't. And I feel like I'm a self-fulfilling prophecy because I wanted to become a world champion, then I believed I could become a world champion, and I actually became a world champion, and I wasn't born one. Mm. I worked really hard at becoming it. And we don't want to set our kids up for failure, so therefore we don't want to tell them that they can be anything they want to be. What if they don't want to be anything? Well, I don't think that's a really healthy aspect to have in life, is it? Like, want to be something and then pursue it with vigour and gusto and love and passion and understand that there's going to be times when it's not going to work out, and that those challenges and those setbacks, those obstacles, they're wonderful opportunities for growth and improvement. They present you with an opportunity to analyse and prioritise and reassess and go, hang on, we're moving in the wrong direction. We need to figure out which way we need to go now, and it's that way. So as long as you stay on your path and understand that when things are going bad, first you have to accept it is what it is. Don't surrender to it, but accept that it is what it is. Stop resisting it, let it go, and then create an action plan and keep going. Because there was plenty of times in those first 8 years of my surfing career when it was crap. I was having a horrible time, and then I was sabotaging it, and then I was wondering why I wasn't getting the results that I wanted. So I had to accept that it is what it is. Now, what am I going to do something different? Because, you know, what they say about insanity is doing the same thing over and expecting a different result.
What when you finally got that first world championship, or actually any of the seven, like, what's it feel like to be a world champion? Because I don't know about you, Nick, but I've got a feeling it might have passed me by.
In a sporting prowess, perhaps, Andrew. But, you know,
I think
the
many...
only limitations in life are the ones that are self-imposed.
Okay, all right. Well, let's just stay with the
then
sporting
one. Then
you've
got to be realistic.
Oh, you just ruined everything.
Sorry, mate. Don't allow me to dictate terms to you.
Thought he was off the hook.
If you want to feel like what it's like to become a world champion, then come into my house, go walk into my trophy room and grab one of my trophies. It's pretty special. It's an amazing experience to be able to claim and say that you are the best in the world at something. And it's also pretty arbitrary because maybe the best surfer in the world wasn't competing that year or that day.
Yeah.
But the thing is that you rose above, you triumphed over tragedy, you set yourself above, you took all the risks, and you actually came out trumps. And it's a wonderful thing to be able to say that I'm a world champion. And the great thing is about becoming a world champion in an athletic pursuit is, unlike being a CEO or a general manager or one of those things, those titles dissipate as you lose. And, you know, as your career starts to change, your titles go away. But the great thing about being a world champion is those titles can never be taken away from you, unless you're like Lance Armstrong, and then that's a whole other story.
Yeah. Do your surfing titles define you now?
No. No, not at all.
How much mongrel do you need to get to the absolute top of the heap?
Well, from my own personal experience, that's exactly what I relied on, was nothing but mongrel. But that was world title 1-6. And then world title number 7 was a completely different experience because I trusted in my ability and instincts, and I also was grateful. So essentially I was competing from 1-6 in a state of fear. Fear of rejection, fear of abandonment, fear of unworthiness, fear of being unloved. And so I was constantly in this state of necessity to prove a point to the world that I'm worthy of love, that I'm the best in the world, and I'm the greatest. And I was just proving a point continuously until I hit 6 and went, okay, I think I've proved the point. And then after I won 6, I had 2 years of really serious injury, and I came back with a renewed sense of appreciation and gratitude and love for the sport, as opposed to this necessity to win. If you're not with me, then get out of my way. I saw you as in the way, not on the way. Whereas with world title number 7, everything that happened was on the way.
Right.
It was really fluid. It was a really enjoyable process. I was in a state of gratitude. Every time I was in the water, I was looking around going, wow, I can't believe I still get paid to do this. I can't believe it's such a beautiful day. I'm in Brazil, Hawaii, France, wherever I was, just in a complete sense of gratitude. So much so, for the first time in my life, I would come out of the water after losing a final and still be grateful.
Yeah, right.
And so,
do you think you were better in the 7th?
Yes, yes, way better. And it was way easier, and it was way more fun.
Well, I think fun is a word that I'm starting to hear a lot more from speakers talking about. Actually, know what is fun for you.
Yes, it's important that you do. And you take, and then not only finding out what that is, but then committing the time to do it every day, which is a surf every day.
Well, you'll have to have a surf on one of Andrew's boards. He's always taking photos of them and putting them on Facebook and Instagram.
Lane, I'll give you
You know what? Andrew's boards are like other people's children's. You have to love them as much as he does.
I'll give you one Felix made for Jazzy to have a go on. You'll love it.
Well, I might not, but I'll certainly let you know.
Okay. Listen, Lane, great to talk, and it's great to know that now you're still travelling the world and still making a better place, but now doing it in a more corporate sense with some pretty big and pretty impressive audiences. So,
great fun. It's been great fun working with you too, Andrew. And if I can just give a little shameless plug about making the world better, I also have my own foundation, Aim for the Stars, which is all about providing financial and moral support for young women and girls to achieve their dreams in all endeavours, music, science, culture, sports, academia, business, you name it. We do it. Over the last 11 years, we've given over $600,000 worth of grants to over 300 girls. So it's all about making the world a better place.
It is. We'll put that up on our site as well.
So thank you.
Good on you, Lane. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Lane.
Cheers, boys. See you.
Great to chat. See ya. So there you go, Nick. What do you think of Lane Beachley? Pretty impressive, eh?
Rock and roll. Thought it was amazing. Loved it every moment of it.
Yeah, she is. She's an amazing
an ambassador for Get a Freaking Life.
Yeah, she is. She's good fun too. And listen, honestly, my son makes boards. I mean, I make them too, but his are really good. So I do want to get it onto one of them.
Well, there you go. I facilitated that for you. I want you to always, recognise that.
Okay. Thanks. All right. So listen, getafreakinglife.com is the web address. You'll find Lane there and at the Facebook site as well, which is...
Facebook.com/getafreakinglife.
All right, Nick. Good fun. Really enjoying it.
See you in the surf.
See you, mate.